We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Yeah, so it's Danny Boy O'Connor, former rapper, museum executive director at the Outsiders House Museum. And the first story that comes to mind as far as interactions with law enforcement is actually embarrassing for me to tell. It's egg on my face, but I tell it, I'll tell it if it serves an example of the growth on my part. But it was during the LA riots. I was, unfortunately, I have to admit, I took part in some of the looting. I was living in Hollywood, California at the time, and the city was on fire. And it just seemed like a big free-for-all. Since I've made amends in ways that I, you know, probably can't go into, and some of them are just living amends, but that's neither here nor there. I was in the San Fernando Valley during the riots on another night when there was a curfew, and I was drinking, and I had a girl with me, and we were coming up to Panga Canyon, leaving Tommy's, and I think I got in an argument either with the person at the window of the burger spot, and I may have, you know, who knows what I was, man, I used to drink a lot, dude, and I used to run my mouth, and I used to be nice with my hands and put them on just about everybody. And so I told him to screw, and as I was telling him, you know, eat shit and all that. Oh, can I curse, by the way? Is that cool?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Should have asked that, you know. As I'm telling him, go screw, call the cops, do whatever you want, the cops went by. I was like, oh, no. So I peeled out, and I was gone. Well, they got that call. And they followed me up the street, and they caught me maybe five lights later. And by the way, I'm gonna preface the story. This story sucks. I don't, you know, but I got pulled over. The guy was actually cool about it. He just wanted to get some information to see why they're calling from the hamburger stand from Tommy's, and why am I out during the curfew, even though it was curfew, he was being cool. And I started to run my mouth and tell him this, that, and the third, fuck you. Don't you know, you guys, you know, aren't you in enough trouble already being, you know, LAPD as a whole because of the whole Rodney King thing and blah, blah, blah. And he said, you know what, motherfucker, I was going to be cool. I was going to let you go. I just needed some information. Now go fuck yourself. He was using proper English, by the way. And he allowed the girl to take the car. He could see clearly I was a little bent. All that to say, I did go to jail during the riot. By the time we got to the West Valley PD station, there was a line, I mean, a mile long. It felt like a mile long. There were so many people getting booked in that night. I was very familiar with that station. That was my local neighborhood station. They were very familiar with me, unfortunately. And as I started to sober up a little, I wasn't stupid drunk at that point, so I don't know that I could have got arrested for that as well. But I ran in, the officer was passing me, and I started to make an apology because quickly I realized it was me that was the problem. I said, too late, buddy. I was trying to be cool back there, but I said, hey, it's not about that. And he said, yeah, well, you know, have a good one. And the line was so long, man, that I started to, I still was coming in and out of drunk Danny and semi-conscious Danny, and I decided, you know what, this line is long. I don't know that anybody will notice me walking off, and so I started to walk through that parking lot handcuffed up, and I made it almost to the wall. And if you know anything about the West Valley PD station, which maybe nobody probably does, but at that time the wall was about hip high for me. I'm 6'6", and I was like, I'm free. I'm home. I know how to. Yeah. And right as I was getting close to that wall, someone was like, hey, hey, hey. Someone was doing a report in their car, and they grabbed me back and they pulled me in.
Oh, man.
And you know what? I tell that story not with any type of, it was one of a million stories. It was the first one that came to mind when you said about, you know, any interactions with law enforcement. As a kid growing up, man, I never had any problem with law enforcement. Anytime that I came into contact with cops, it was usually because I was up to no good. And as I got older, especially as I got sober, which, you know, I just celebrated in April 15th, 18 years of consecutive years of sobriety here. And this is not my first go of it. I had a lot more empathy for the one of the most unthankful and most necessary jobs in the world, man. My experience with all the people. Listen, not all people. Name a profession that doesn't have, you know, unsavory personalities in at some form or another. I mean, I was a touring musician for 30 years. It's easier for me to name you the good guys in that industry than it's a lot quicker because there's a lot less of them than the jerk offs. all that to say, you know, looking back, you know, a lot of the things that any experience that I've had for the most part with law enforcement could have went either way. It was determining the deciding factor was how I reacted or acted when coming into contact. So when I have somebody that I care about, black, white, pinstripe, don't matter, woman, man, child, whatever, if I love them or if they're in my close circle and we start to really talk, I always say, hey man, listen, if you get pulled over, here's what I want you to do. I want you to roll both windows down, especially if they're tinted. If you have a key in the ignition, I want you to put it on the dashboard. I want you to put your hands where they can see that. I want you to ask to go to your wallet before you reach down. And I want you to ask to go to the glove compartment, because this is what I do. I said, I smile. My license is valid. My insurance is valid. And even if they weren't, nothing's going to get better by getting, because I used to be the guy, unfortunately, that would be like, yo, why are you pulling me over? What the fuck? What the, all of that shit. And I can imagine, you know, empathy is imagining, you know, someone else's shoes. I can imagine if I come to a car and people are talking greasy and they look like they're a little whacked, and I'm like, fuck these motherfuckers. You know, so I've learned with an attitude adjustment on my part, because I'm responsible for my side of the street, that my results go through the roof as far as quality experiences with in any situation. And if people, especially, like I said, I demand it of my friends, especially like in this, you know, that they, if they don't act like this in today, right now, like I don't fuck with them really. Like I have associates or people that I know that I like, but if there's still cowboys out there and they're still wilding out in those areas, I really don't break bread with those people, because those are not people I want to move forward with. So anyway, if there's a moral to this, man, is that could have went a lot better for me had I was in the wrong still. He just needed a little information. So I try my best now to bring that same kind of, you know, just bring good energy wherever I go, man. And I hope that is an okay
cop. The best part is I'm so into the story. I'm like rooting for you. I'm hoping you get over the wall.
I was so close. It was like a dream sequence, bro. I was that close to, and it was one of those walls I could have just literally sat up on and then made it over. Getting out of cuffs is not as hard as you think. And I believe it or not, I used to keep a handcuff key in the back of that Levi patch.
Very wise.
When your hands are back there, there's where the key could be. I will tell you this, man. I grew up, you know, I'm a native New Yorker, came to LA at 6 years old. By the time I was 12 years old, or maybe a little, you know, less younger than that. But around that time, I started to realize that, like, we weren't all created equal. And there wasn't, like, you know, it was economics for me. It wasn't color or race or religion or any of that shit. We were all different shapes, sizes, and the like. But I realized, wow, some guys got Tigras, you know, and some guys got Lacoste, you know. Some guys are getting a car at 16 and some guys are not, you know. Some guys got shit bicycles and some guys got Mongoose Webcos and Diamondbacks, and I did not. And so
some guys are Bebo on Red's bike.
Yeah, and I tell you that to tell you that, you know, it was easy for me as a kid to feel less than. What I got at home was not what I come from a broken home. Father went to prison when I was 2 months old, never really seen him. The two times that I did see him, or he came around, he put his hands on my mother, and had an abusive stepfather as well, who was an alcoholic and died at 35 of cirrhosis of the liver. So I got sober this time at 35, and it wasn't the first time I had been sober. I had 3.5 years prior to getting sober 18 years ago, but I got sober at 35, and that really hit me, because I was like, wow, even at 35, even though I felt old, you know, when you're 35, you're like, damn, I'm getting old. Now I'm 54, but at 35, I felt like, damn, I'm getting old. But I also was like, damn, I'm young. How hard do you have to drink to die at 35 of cirrhosis? And so, listen, unfortunately for him, he didn't find the solution, or my father didn't find the solution that I found in sobriety. My father was murdered, unfortunately, by the chief of police's son in Staten Island, New York, while he was sleeping, you know, being homeless. They poured gas on him and lit him up just for shits and giggles, I guess. And and that's a whole other, you know, and again, I tell you all that to tell you that, you know, growing up, I felt I felt less than. It was something that I believed inside, that as I am by myself, I'm not enough. And the mm-hmm. way I solved that was going to my local mall, which growing up in the 80s, we grew up in, especially in Southern California. I mean, mall culture was everything. And what I realized, it was a fast runner and a slick talker, and I was good at stealing. And so if you had Guess jeans and they had Guess jeans and I didn't have Guess jeans, I'd go to the mall and help myself to some Guess jeans. And I was constantly stealing. I realized by the time I was in high school that being 6'6", maybe at the time I was 6'3", 6'4", scrawny, skinny. When I see photos, I actually just bought, I never had a yearbook in my life. My mother never, you know, indulged us with the, she never wrote a check for them basically. But mm-hmm. I found them on the internet the year I went to high school 1 year and that was it. But I found 7th, 8th, and 9th, and I looked like, you know, Alfred E. Newman from Man Magazine. And, but by 17, I was already arrested for, you know, attempted murder for a shooting that happened in a park because I was already in a punk rock gang, and we were already mixing it up. And when I see that little kid's photo in that yearbook at Taft High School, and I look at that was the year I was doing that shit, I was thinking, God damn, like already, like it's just. Talking about dying at 35 of cirrhosis, I was like, man, I was like 16, 17. Yeah, 17 years old. And I'm already, you know,
yeah,
getting involved in that kind of stuff. So why am I telling you all that? Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, man. I was just going to say, like, you said at 17, you were in like a punk rock gang and involved mm-hmm. in a shooting. And I know you were just saying like how you had a lot of trouble at home and that sort of thing. What was the scene like for you and how did you get involved in that? Like into that game.
The punk rock gang thing?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, do you know about punk rock gangs or are you familiar with that?
Dude, I grew up in the punk rock scene. And so when
my buddy. That kind of draw, I'm sorry to interrupt, yeah. but you sound like you've been in a punk rock scene from Kentucky.
Let me tell you, dude, there's nothing. Hey! No, listen, there's nothing yeah, crazier than when I tell people like how I grew up and they hear me and they assume. Yeah.
Oh, that you're listening like to Leonard Skinner and this is like some fantasy you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah. Put it this way, man. I was 10 years old when I started listening to Minor Threat, Dead Kennedys, Suicidal Tendencies, started going to shows when I was 13. So
where at? In LA?
No. We'll just say in the South, man. We'll say okay. South. Yeah.
There you
I'll
go.
Tell you offline all about it, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So similar mm-hmm. for me, two things that come to mind. You said Minor Threat, which I love. I just found out that Two Times You is a cover song, which is one of my favorite really? Minor Threat song by a band called Wire in 1977 or 78.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Pink Flag is the name of the record. Record is genius, man. It's the first post-punk record. Anyway, if you're listening mm-hmm. at home. Number two is Suicidal Tendencies. So I grew up on, I had a very estranged, is that the word? Yeah, relationship with my mother, basically she never wanted kids and definitely was not, you know, interested in being there other than, you know, she kept a roof over our head and fed us and clothed us and that was fine, but was never really involved in my life. So I say that to tell you that she had a wonderful taste in music. I grew up on Motown. Coming to LA, they were calling me Disco Dan. Those were fighting words back then because in the 70s, you didn't want to be known as Disco anything. Right, I grew up with it. I roller skated a lot and ice skated at the Topanga Mall, which is San Fernando Valley area. And so I was very, you know, into like anything with a backbeat, which set me up for hip hop early on, especially as a white guy, you know, from New York. But when Suicidal Tendencies album first came out, I believe it was 82, Frontier Records, I was intrigued. I think the Beastie Boys came out around, you know, a couple years later than that. But anyway, so Suicidal comes out. I love that look. I'm starting to get to that age where, you know, like 9th grade, 10th grade, a lot of kids are starting to, you know, to change how they look, change how they act. I think economics plays a big role in that. You know, if you've got a tight knit family, if you got a family that cares, you're doing sports, they're watching out for you. You're already starting to figure out where you're going to work at 16. Yeah. You're trying to get through high school, picking a college. But if you're a latchkey kid and you ain't got no supervision, I ended up at the nightclubs, man. There were teen nightclubs, famous ones, Hot Tracks, Phases, Cafe de Grand for punk shows. I'm trying a million others, 321 in Santa Monica, Fabian's, a million different, you know. And so I was out wild. I was like, you know, free range, man. I went anywhere I wanted. The edict at home was just don't wake me up when you come home. In other words, don't make enough noise that my mother gets woken up and can't go back to sleep because she got to be at work at 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. And the Suicidal Tendency for me, just the aesthetic of white dudes dressing like cholos, you know, getting it in was appealing because when you don't have any money and you, mm-hmm. you know, the Dickies don't cost a lot of money. Flannels don't cost a lot of money. Winos, the shoes or Vans, yeah. you know, it's like, it's, and, you know, I was a tough kid. And so, also going to punk gigs back then, you could get your head flown if you weren't, if you were alone, because I used to go every summer until I was about 14 back to New Jersey, New York and New Jersey for the summers to stay with my cousins. And we went to gigs in New Jersey, man. And it would just be like, it only just take one big old skinhead looking dude to just look around mm-hmm. at the crowd and just go, you, and just want to fly you and just or bang you out because you were just there. And so in LA, it was really like that. So there was a lot of gangs that started to, like, I started to notice on the scene, there were a lot of different gangs out there. You know, Lads was one of them, was one of the early ones. I was from a gang called Mickey Mouse Club, which was a, you know, started from the dudes that were former Lads and then were in the Valley. There was a big gang called FFF, which was like the tier one, like the baddest of those dudes in the Valley. A lot of Mexican gangs as well kind of coexisted around that stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, La Mirada Punks and Circle One the Family, and I'm trying to think who I'm missing. But there was a handful, and then other subsets of that, Mota Locos and Sacred Reich and blah, blah, blah. So there was a full scene of punk rock gangs. There's even an article. I just bought another copy of it, but in Rolling Stone magazine in 86, unfortunately, a guy from that gang FFF died. And it was like national news, and they did a big write-up on it. And then that write-up gets turned into a movie called Lost Angels, which was Ad-Rock from the Beastie Boys' first real role. He did a few things prior to that. And I watched that movie and thought I was watching a biography. I was like, how fucking weird is this? Because never knowing it was taken from that story, because in that story they mentioned, you know, obviously FFF, the kid they got killed, the Mickey Mouse Club, they mentioned the Lads, they mentioned this whole subculture of white gangs, punk rock gangs, with some, we had Mexican dudes in our gang, we had black dudes in our gang, we were out there, you know. And so that's what I was doing. That was my high school. I was stealing from the malls. I was into hip hop early, but I was also into punk rock. Both of those things. If you're a white kid and you're listening to punk rock and dressing like a cholo, or you're listening to Run DMC and Beastie Boys and all that, you were just an outcast. That was your music. Mm-hmm. It was like, it was your thing. And so I can tell you this, growing up in Canoga Park, California, but going to, you know, a school, which was like the upper crust thing, is if I was at your house and your parents came home, it was 9 times out of 10, you'd get the like, you know, hey, can I talk to you in the kitchen, please? And then I knew that was my cue. They took one look at me. They're like, that guy got to go. And I wasn't even doing a lot, you know, at first I wasn't doing anything wrong. But when you get that enough, you're like, fuck it, you know, let me just get into it. And so, yeah, I was always up to something as a kid. And, you know, I don't have kids, but looking at it from where I sit now, man, if I had a kid, I would do my best to help navigate better, man. I think I was just lost, and just, you know, if nobody's looking out for you, you start to do whatever comes easy or what comes natural to you. For me, it was, I was also, how can I tell you that we romance the criminal, we romance the rebel, we romance. I mean, this is the American spirit. Mm-hmm. It just is. I mean, there's just no other way around to saying
that. Well, that's the thing too. That's why I was asking about how you got into it, because it's almost the same story for everyone that I've ever met. I've been doing stuff for almost, well, right at 2 decades, Bloods, Crips, Sereños, Latin Kings, Gangster Disciples. Like, we got them all in the South. And the common theme is the same thing. Like, people are looking for acceptance. They're having some stuff going on at home. And then they find this clique, this group of peers that's like, you know, you're willing to die for them because you're fighting with them. You know what I mean? Like, someone, And that's why I asked too. You take that, and then you also have 17-year-old brain that hasn't fully developed. You know, your frontal lobe is still developing, and add in alcohol or any other kind of drugs.
Yeah, peer pressure, alcohol. Yeah. It wanted to be accepted. Plus, like I said, well, I didn't say, but I would tell you, because I've said it a million times to everybody else. I mean, I saw The Outsiders, the movie, on its theatrical release in 83, which is 40 years ago. I was 13 or 14. And for the first time in my life, I saw how I felt inside being portrayed in a different era, but basically the same, man. Like, these kids didn't have anybody at home. For the Curtis family, if you're familiar with the book or the movie, they lost their parents to a tragic accident. They got hit by a train. at the crossing, so that the older brother has to now look out for his younger brothers. He's trying to be the dad and hold the family together. Mm-hmm. You know, but the other kids in the neighborhood, Dallas Winston and Johnny Cade and Two-Bit, they're like strays that all hang out. And it was them against the world. They were all they had. And at 14, I said, man, if that's the best life gets, I can deal with that. Because what that was them replicating what they lost, which is a family. And they make we make those families outside. And originally that was the – so I'll tell you, you know, other than being predisposed to loving hip-hop because I have a disco and R&B in my background due to my mother's choice of music, which I always loved, and roller skating as well in the 70s was like, oh, it's all we did. And so when hip-hop came around, I was fascinated, and it was a New York thing, and I was a, you know, a disconnected New Yorker who had been, you know, brought to California at age six, and I always still felt like I belonged in New York. But when hip-hop came out, what I loved about it was that, you know, if you want to be in a rock band and you want to be a great guitarist, which every kid does, I'm sure, at one point, that's like, that looks like 9 hours of isolation a day in your room, learning your pentatonic scales, like just bugging out by yourself. Like, you want to do hip hop, you really need other people to do that hip hop, man. You need a cipher, you need a, you break dance and you can't break, I mean, I guess you can practice alone, but you take it out, you run with other kids. So I started to dress a certain way, which started to identify me as a different scene. And then I started to go out to the mall, to the clubs, to wherever, and I would see other people who were dressing and looking like me, and then we started to click, and then we started to make clicks, and then before long there was my family of choice. So those were music, and that was like my savior, because through music I was able to connect with like-minded people. Some of them weren't in the situation I were in, you know what I mean? They didn't mm-hmm. have as much fun either, and they didn't also end up in as much handcuffs. But you know, yeah. I met a lot of other kids that were latchkey kids, straight kids, a lot of kids to speak into the suicidal part of it, you mm-hmm. know, a lot of kids that I knew were coming out of boys' homes and juvenile hall at the time, and they were already fluent in the cholo lifestyle, because when you get to even CYA or you get to juvenile hall, it's like predominantly, you know, Mexican run. And so you get with that program mm-hmm. quick. So a lot of dudes I knew that were white were starting to speak with a little Spanglish going on, me included. You know, I was starting buying Teen Angels and writing, you know, gang writing. I was really good at, you know, hitting that stuff up. And again, it's growing up in Southern California, you know, punk rock looked like cholos to everywhere else in the world, because of mm-hmm. suicidal, because of the skateboarding mm-hmm. scene. And because of, you know, the bands that I like too were like Agent Orange and Ill Repute, Stalag 13, yes. Dr. No, all that yeah. skate fast yeah. aggressive punk was what I liked. I was definitely not a, you know, Sex Pistols fan whatsoever back then. Now, completely different story, you know, and
yeah.
Jonesy's, you know, I consider him a good friend, you know, from the Sex Pistols, and Paul Cook as well. But when I was of that age, that album was for like older cats. It just didn't resonate the way
yeah.
that, you know, suicidal record spoke to me in that way. And so, but music was my family. And then I saw what the Suicidal Tendencies do. If they came into a punk gig, they were in their 40 deep, all with their flannels bolted up and their hats flipped up, and you just were like, everybody would get to the side. I mean, I like, yeah. I was attracted to that. No different than mm-hmm. at the Outlaw. I was an Outlaw Bike Club too, years later. And it's the same thing, man. You see these dudes walk in with that kind of respect, and you're just like, damn, I want to get down with that kind of shit. And if I can't get down to it with it, I'm going to try to make my own of that, that thing. So,
yeah. So before we get, I'm going to come to the club thing too. You mentioned the Outsiders, and I didn't even do a full intro on you, and I'm cool with it because we're rolling with the conversation. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about the Outsiders, you actually have the Outsiders Museum now, the Curtis Family House.
Correct. So I bought the house from the movie in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm coming to you live right now from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I am a native New Yorker who was born in New York and came to L.A. when I was six, and I left L.A. about 5.5 years ago, never thinking I would ever leave L.A. I'm glad I did leave LA, but that's for other reasons now. But I'm here. I own the museum. If you're not familiar, it started out as a book, The Outsiders, by a female author who was mm-hmm. 15 and a half when she wrote the book here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in high school. She failed English that year, got a D+ in creative writing. The book just celebrated 55, 54 years. It sells more copies now than ever. It's never been out of print in that many years, which is also probably a Guinness Book record. She's still alive and well, living in Midtown. And it's a story of a broken family that ends up looking out for each other. It's just the stories of the haves and the have-nots. It's mm-hmm. the kids from the wrong side of the tracks and kids from the right side of the tracks, and their struggles to find the center line and to find the same sunset. And that story always resonated with me. I saw it, like I said, in a theatrical release in March of 83. I only know that now because I got a PhD in Greaserology. I wouldn't have been able to tell you those things if I didn't buy the house and turn it into a museum, but it wasn't a museum when I bought it. But I saw that movie, it changed my life. And I've carried that swagger, that Dallas Winston, which was the Matt Dillon character's swagger with me. It's in House of Pain. It's in all the other things that I've done. Every time I look back in photos, I really see how impactful it was, because I don't think I've been without a denim jacket since 83 in some photo or another, just doing my, you know, my Dallas Winston cool guy thing. And I never thought, you know, if you told me 5.5 years ago or a little bit more that I'd be living in Tulsa, Oklahoma and own the house in the movie and turn it into a museum, I would have thought you were smoking something. But here we are. It's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And I've had a lot of cool things happen to me. And, you know, it's a 180 from anything I could have expected. And it's really,
How does that even come about? I mean, you see the movie at 13, obviously it has a huge impact on your life.
Yeah.
Several years later, you end up owning the house. Did you seek it out?
How several years later. Yeah. Like 30 something years.
Yeah.
I'll tell you.
Yeah. So, how did that happen?
Yeah. So by the time I'm 20, like, so I went to high school for 1 year. I hung out for three. I was always up to no good. When that started to fizzle out, everybody started to either go to college or get real jobs or go to off to prison, whatever. You were going up or down. I started to go, what am I going to do with my life? And I ran into a guy that I went to school with, or we ran around the same circles, a kid named Everlast. He had just come out of a deal with Rhyme Syndicate and Ice-T. He put a solo record out. Solo record didn't do so well, but I was a fan. There's no other way to say it. I was amazed that he could, that, you know, being from, you know, Canoga Park, California, he was also a native New Yorker that grew up, you know, in California at the time. And just being the guy in my neighborhood could rhyme like that, I was all in. What I did notice, though, was that, like, the stuff he was saying didn't really appeal per se. Like, if you're a white guy, another white guy don't want to hear how to be black, and a black guy don't want to hear a white boy rhyming about the black experience. And I felt like, look, if I could just get him to pivot, we could do something, you know, because it was like the natural marketing guy in me. Also, prior to that, I worked 2 years at a record store as the product manager. They gave me that gig by default. I was literally a cashier who lucked into the best job in the record store. So my musical IQ was through the roof, and I understood branding and logos and marketing really well, because it was my job to put out stuff on and decide what goes on the end caps and what gets displayed in the right places. So I had a intuitive understanding at a young age about product, and I loved it anyway. I loved the graphic aspect of it. And so we ended up putting a band together. He wrote one of the greatest hits of hip hop history, Jump Around. And mm-hmm. I say that, you know, that's all him. I did not write that song. I do not, you know, receive any royalties from that song. But that song will define, you know, every time it comes on, you'll think of me, Lethal and Everlast. I mean, the House of Pain. It was my band. It was my name. It was my logo. So I did the back end. He did the front end. And we rode off into the sunset, and thing was great. And then, you know, three albums later, it fell apart. He went on to even greater success as a solo artist. Our DJ joined Limp Bizkit, which we had met. They had opened for us in Florida somewhere. He ends up DJing and producing some tracks, and they invite him into the band. And so he does good. And then I throw myself like a 4.5 year pity party, because I didn't know where to go from there. When you're the marketing guy, when you're the branding guy, when you're that without the musical component of that, you really, it's not as easy as one might mm-hmm. think. It's the worst seat in the house when things fall apart. And it's mm-hmm. the worst seat in the house when you design it up front and everybody needs that. And then the band keeps going on. Then you get the whole, what have you done for me lately? So mm-hmm. everybody forgets how crucial that was to the starting and the birth of something. But then it's like, well, you don't rap like that anymore. You don't create any music. I'm like, yeah, dude, but I'm the one that does the branding and the merch that got us here that right. sells more than the records. But don't let me. Yeah. So it happens with all bands. It's just the way it is. And so At some point, the front man will always be like, it's my shit, you know? And mm-hmm. So we broke up. I ended up becoming a drug addict, and then in and out of sobriety. And in 2005, I get sober. This is the 18 years that I just celebrated. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, getting sober, I put a side group together with DJ Lethal. DJ Lethal was, like I said, the DJ in House of Pain, also Limp Bizkit's current DJ and member of that band since, you know, 98, before they blew up. And he had a record deal, and I was finding people for him to sign. And we found a few people. We figured, instead of making one record, three records, why don't we combine them and make one? And that turns into a band called La Cosa Nostra. And just to speed it up for you, Everlast ended up getting intrigued by what we were doing and decided he wanted to join that band. And that took us on our first tour. And in that first tour, we played the historic Kane's Ballroom, which is about a mile down the street from where I'm at now. It's the CBGBs of the Midwest. If you don't know, it's a rite of passage for most bands. Every band that you love has played here, and every time they play somewhere way bigger, they come and take a photo out front of Canes for old time's sake, or they play Canes. You know, Jack White plays three nights sold out there. He could play across the street at the BOK Center, which is a stadium, but he'd rather play three nights at the historic juke joint from the, you know, the 30s. And we had a 3-day layover, and it occurred to me that this town was strangely familiar to me, and I couldn't place it on day one. But on day two, we got bored, and we got a car driver to take us around town. And the best he could do was take us to a mall or offer us to go look at the Rose Garden. And I think, well, that ain't going to get it. And all of a sudden, I go, wait a minute. I had that epiphany. I go, this place seems so familiar. Holy shit. I said, driver, was The Outsiders filmed here? And he said, yes, absolutely. He goes, and Susie, S.C. Hinton, also still lives here and went to school here. And I was like, oh, my God. And that began the quest looking for filming locations. Prior to, you know, this is 2009. There wasn't a lot on the internet about this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I was able to find the drive-in from the movie, the park from the movie. And by finding the park, I found the house, which is an eye shot of the park from the movie. How well you know the movie, I don't know. But mm-hmm. that house was for sale when I got there. It was $42,000. At the time, I was just getting back on my feet, but I did have $42,000, I believe. And if not, I could have probably wrangled it up somehow. I was very interested. I was like, holy fuck, I couldn't believe, one, it was still on Earth. Two, that it was for sale. And three, how cheap it was. Because $42,000 in 2009, I mean, how's that possible? So I take a photo out front. I get to the Kane's Ballroom for rehearsal, and the owner or the manager of the Kane's Ballroom says, hey, man, I was just talking with your road manager. He tells me you're good friends with Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols. I said, yeah, that's true. He goes, you know, the Sex Pistols played their second to last show on their only U.S. tour in this building. And on their way out, Sid Vicious punched a hole in the green room. We cut that out during the remodeling. We framed it in the office if you want to see it. I said, yeah, absolutely. So I took a selfie in front of The Outsiders' house, and I took a selfie in Kane's Ballroom in front of this vicious hole, put it on social media, and my social media got a lot of response, a lot of positive response. Now, I don't know if you remember early Facebook, but early Facebook or any of it was, people were scared to put likes because they didn't know what that implied. They didn't know if they were like, you know, like, I don't want to give it a lot. That's weird. I'm not going to like it, you know, and now whatever.
Yeah.
But I got so many likes on that I thought, man, I'm onto something here. I said, there's obviously a lot of people who love the nostalgic pop culture like I do. And for the first time in, you know, human history, I'm on a tour bus with remote access to this great vast thing called the internet. There's social media, which is basically my own television channel. I got a smartphone, which is basically a map and a it plays, it records, it camera, it's every, I mean, I'm like, dude. So I started to use that tour bus like a time machine, and every city we would hit, I would look for historical locations, Mickey Mantle's grave in Texas, or you know, the JFK, you know, book depository. Some of them were obscure, some of them were common if you lived in those areas. Mary Tyler Moore's house in Minneapolis was a good one. When I got to New York, I went looking for Summer of Sam, Son of Sam stuff for the murderer, and looking for the locations that were. And I start to Photoshop the before and after, and I put it online. And I started a thing called the Delta Bravo Urban Exploration Team. And that also caught fire. and started to bring a lot of interesting characters. And that's how I meet a friend of mine who's still my dear friend, if not my best friend, a guy we call Nako Nolan. And we met just through randomly on the internet. And he had the same, you know, affinity for this kind of stuff. And we started going and exploring ad nauseum all through Los Angeles. And anytime we'd go out of town, we would do the same. And we started getting courted by all kinds of TV production companies. Originally, it was Mark Brunette, who does Shark Tank and Survivor. They wanted to turn what we did into a TV show. Unfortunately, he also works for the city, so he couldn't say what he did for a living on camera, per se. Mm-hmm. And they kept wanting us to do, like, ghost stories or more true crime. And we were like, yeah, we can do that, but that's not really what we love to do. We love to do the pop culture stuff, the television shows, the records covers, the... And so we went through a few different big, long interviews with big, prestigious companies, but it just didn't pan out. But the hobby still exists today. We have, you know, thousands of people on the internet that are on a private page called the Delta Bravo Urban Exploration Team. It was all inspired by the photo I took out in front of the Outsider's house and the hole that Sid Vicious allegedly punched in the wall. And for the next 5 years, we started to do this hobby. And at the time, I wasn't making much money. You know, that band, La Cosa Nostra, you know, it did all right, but it was just the music industry was crumbling, you know, in real time. And touring became more and more expensive to do. And with the band with like 6 or 7 people, it wasn't feasible to go out as much as we needed to make it, you know. So I was, what I like to say is I was cash poor, but I was time rich. And I encourage anybody, if you don't have a lot of cash, if you do have the time, that's still a very fucking valuable commodity, if not more than the money. Ask Steve Jobs how much he would have given to have a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. more time here. So I used my time wisely, and I started to explore, and I started to press the limits of how far I could drive to go see famous locations and I started to just go, why can't I drive to Tulsa? Why can't I go out there? I got a couple of weeks. I'm going to go over space. And it ended up taking me 2 days to drive here. And you know, I like the drive. It clears my head. And I get to listen to music and lay all the puzzle pieces in the imaginary, you know, vision board. And so I started to dig it. And I started to show up in Tulsa. And every year I would come here, I noticed that the Habitat for Humanities was getting closer and closer to that house. That house wasn't for sale anymore. There were tenants living in there. They weren't doing a good job as tenants. They were kind of tearing that place to shreds. And by the... I had a call come in. Sorry about that. I realized that if somebody didn't do something about this house, that it might not make it because they were tearing all of these homes down in this area of Tulsa. And so I started to inquire. I started to ask the tenants. They were kind of suspicious of why I wanted to know who the owner was and where I could get in touch with them. But finally they gave it up to a friend of mine who lives here. I kept saying, go over there and ask again. And he finally got them to give us the information. And we made the call and the lady said, it is not on the market, but I am ready to sell. I do realize that they're trying to tear it to shreds. And she said, I won't take a penny less than 20 grand. And my buddy said, we won't give you a penny more than 15. We saw it and she agreed. So I ended up buying the Outsider's house for 15 grand. It was the best deal I ever got, but I promise you it wasn't a steal because when I did, I bought it sight unseen other than being out front of it, you know, when I was on tour and then the couple times that I came to town to look at it. But when I got inside, I realized it was all of $15,000 was there. It was a complete teardown, but I was able to humble myself and go on the internet and ask for help. And then the help came and here we are now, you know, five and change later with an incredible museum. So.
That's what I was going to say. And maybe I heard this wrong through rumor mill or whatever, but did people start volunteering to do the work like roofers and electricians? And-
Absolutely. So I'm glad you said that. I can honestly tell you that was a life-changing experience for me. Mm-hmm. The first thought I had when I saw this house for even $42,000 was like, how is that possible? And two, why hasn't somebody bought this and done to like turn it into a museum or even be like, fuck, for 42 grand, I can live in the actual house from the Outsiders. My second thought, once I bought it, was now I understand why nobody bought it. It was such in disrepair. And I thought, well, I must be the only Outsiders fan on the earth who still cares about this shit. But let me just put it on the internet. Let me humble myself. And I have to be clear when I say this, because my ego likes to get in the way and be like, well, you're a famous rapper. You can't go on the internet and ask for help. That's embarrassing. You can't e-beg, you know. And the other voice told me, dude, no, you can actually fucking ask for help. It's not a bad thing. And I often speak to kids a lot, and I'm going to speak to high school next week as well. I at least twice a month, I'm getting asked to either speak at from Rotary clubs to high schools to junior high school. I speak to everybody, and I always tell these kids. I said, "Man, asking for help is probably the most honest, humbling, and straightforward thing you can do." And growing up, I didn't know that. It was a thing of shame if you had to ask for help. You were stupid if you didn't know. You should intuitively know all the stuff that you don't know. And I for some reason felt that that was a shameful thing to do. And that nearly killed me, man. And when I finally got out of my own way and was able to ask for help, the miracle happened, man. And I asked for help and people come out the woodworks. And I've said it a million times, but people would say, hey, man, that grass is up to your waistline. And we want to help you with that. I said, well, how much would that cost? They said, no, sir. After my daughter's soccer practice on Sunday, we'll be by. And there they were. She's still doing a soccer thing, pushing the lawnmower with the dad doing the – someone said, hey, you know, if you don't address that chimney, that thing is going to cave in. You're going to have a bigger problem than you know. And the next thing you know, the chimney guy was in. Everybody was like, man, we love you for saving this thing and taking this project on. How can we help? And, you know, the biggest donor was the author herself. She got behind it as well, which was incredible. Jack White, speaking of, we were 30,000 short from our completion line when he came to town and said, dude, where are you at with this? And I told him I was clear and concise with my numbers. I had just did all of my, you know, looked at. So when he got there, I wasn't like, oh, I don't know, bro. I was like, here's what I need 30 for. Here's what it's going to. And here's where the finish line is. And he said, man, I want to give you 30 grand from last night's show. And 72 hours later, I had 30 grand. He didn't want nothing. He didn't even want it. He didn't even care. We published it. He was like, I said, I got to tell people. He's like, if you want to tell people, that's fine. I'm not looking for any of that. That thing was Billy Idol gave me some money too, which is great. You know, I grew up a big Billy Idol fan. He came to town, man. And, you know, I know him through other people. We're, you know, I would say that we're friends, but we've been in the same room 100 times. We've talked a few times, but it's not like I can call Billy Idol and be like, hey, but Billy, what's going on? But, he came to town and, he was playing and I'm friends with, Billy Morrison, one of his guitar players. And, he said, hey, mate, come see the show. So I get there and we're in the green room and everybody's in the green room behind stage except for Billy Idol. And they go, hey, Billy wants to speak to you in his dressing room. I was like, really? He's like, yeah, go see Billy. So Billy goes, hey, May, how you going? I'm like, oh, I'm good, man. How you doing? You know, keep in mind, I'm like a massive Billy Idol fan. And he said, how you liking Tulsa? I said, oh, man. He goes, oh, you're here now in Tulsa? I said, yeah. He goes, oh, really? He's like, how you like it? I said, oh, I love it. He goes, so you bought a house now? I go, no, I'm still living at the hotel. He goes, mate. The Outsider's house. I said, what? So you know that about the Outsider's house? He says, yeah, mate. He says, I see Jack give you 30 large. I said, you know that Jack White kid? He goes, yeah. He goes, I want to give you money too. I go, you too? He goes, not 30 large, but I'll send you a check. And so I keep the number. The number's nice. It was a fucking great gesture, man. I scanned the check. I framed the check. You just never know where the help's going to come from is my point. And the most of the help came from, you know, everyday salt of the earth, good fans, good Okies, good Tulsans who just saw a guy like me who came to town and heart was in the right place and was trying to take on a project way bigger than he could ever imagine. And they thought, why not help this guy? And I'll never forget how well they've treated me. And even when I don't want to get out of bed some days. I have the most blessed life I could have ever imagined. But there are days where I'm just like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to not do it as in life, but I just don't want to get out of bed, do something. And I committed to speaking or being somewhere. And I always remember, hey, man, those dudes didn't quit out on you. You know, those dudes showed up for you. There was nothing in it for them. So that I'm the kind of guy I've always understood the concept of being a service and I never wanted any part of it because I was always coming from a scarcity mindset or you're getting over on me or whatever. And I saw it in action. And after seeing all of these kind souls that came and helped me, I can't now say, I don't know, that's just theory. That's for suckers. Nobody has, this is I've seen it in actual action. And that has inspired me to always push through when my mind goes, bro, fuck them. You don't owe them nothing, or you don't have to do that. They're not paying you. Because my mind will always default to that fucked setting. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And mm-hmm. pushing through is because of what these people here have done for me, and I will be forever indebted. So it's made me a better man between getting sober and seeing the love of Everyday Tulsans for me has completely given me a whole new energy, a whole new motivation, and a purpose. And I think years after House of Pain, the struggle for me, because I didn't do drugs prior to that. I sold drugs prior to House of Pain. But I was always never going to do drugs. And I started to do drugs because I had lost the plot. I had lost faith in myself, and I had no purpose. And I knew that I was just lost. This thing has given me a purpose. And my purpose is to make sure it's well-maintained, that it stays open to the public, and that we carry the message of hope, which is in the book, The Outsiders, and which you see in the movie. And for me to go speak on what a life-changing event this has been for me by asking for help, and this town has reciprocated in that way. So it's changed everything.
That's a strong message, man. Just because I'm listening to how you grew up and just kind of the picture you're painting, but your persistence and your love for life just keeps putting you in the position to just, I mean, it's crazy. It's destiny, right? You know what I mean? I want to back up a little bit if I can. How old were you when House of Pain blew up?
I think 20, 21.
So you went from...
You 92, went from... So I mean, I'm terrible with math. I'm 54. We started so in a nutshell, Everlast, like I didn't, you know, I'd see him around. If you're a white guy and you're into hip hop in that era, man, there were only, you could count on like one hand the amount of white dudes that were really there. Like, I'm not saying that peripherally people didn't like hip hop. I'm just saying full B-boy, full like in the scene, at the nightclubs. So in the San Fernando Valley, there was the Country Club, which was like a famous rock spot. It was like CBGB's or Kane's or whatever. It was an old, music hall. And they would show, basically all the shows were like, your classic rock shit. But across the street, there was an old roller rink that was kind of defunct. So they use that space now for punk rock gigs and hip hop gigs. Basically all the undesirable, low paying gigs. And that's where you could find me. And if I seen another white boy over there in those spots, you know, going to see UTFO or Bobby Jimmy and the Critters, which was like a comedy type of rap, you would recognize another white boy. You're like, oh shit, okay, he's really real in the scene, because you could get fucked up back in those days. A lot of Bloods and Crips. That was like the height of like the movie Colors. This is like I'm talking 86 to 90, really, till the riots happened, and then all that shit kind of calmed down, because then those dudes had a truce, and that lasted for a minute, but there was a lot of, in the valley back in the days, and during the cocaine epidemic, you know, the crack, shit got real. I mean, you could lose your life just by wearing, you'd be white and into hip-hop, and if I went in a spot with a red hat, that could cost me.
Yeah.
You know, and so I had to be very conscientious of that. I wore a lot of black. Nobody sweated you in navy. Or nobody sweated you in navy blue, because they understood. But if you wore red, and I had some red feelers too, I did do it, and I got checked once or twice, man, where it got a little something, because you could. I'm not trying to. I've never said this out loud before, and I'm just spitballing and thinking out loud. But if you see me with a hoodie and a hat and just my features, you could mistake me for being mulatto and mixed. Mm-hmm. So nobody was looking at me like white boy. They were looking at me like mixed guy who's got a red hat and red feelings on. Fuck this dude. Yeah. You know, like this dude's trying to flag. Like, is he a blood? Yeah. Is he? And in all honesty, you know, Pacoima had a set. It's still a big gang of Pyrus. They're bloods. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those dudes were like, so yeah, it was active at that time. And so, I forget what we were talking about. What we're going back to. Now I'm thinking about all the.
Oh, no, you're good. I love it. The less talking we do, the better it is, right? No, I was just curious. I'm fascinated with the rock star life, right? So if I could be a rock star.
So the hip hop shit. So I run into Everlast. He's one of the rare, he's one of the handful of like dudes in a hip hop that's real at that time. And I see him in that era, and then I don't see him again, you know, until about 1990. I forget where I ran into him, and we exchanged numbers just on some whatever shit. And I call over his house one day, and I hear his mother yelling in the background. She's basically telling him to get his shit and get out because the record deal kind of fell apart. It did fall apart for him. And she, you know, she was like, get a job, get out of here. And at the time, I was doing credit card reprogramming. I didn't do the actual reprogramming, but I used to get credit cards. They would get reprogrammed with somebody else's number. I would get matching IDs, and I was doing it. That will take an hour to unpack. So just trust me when I was doing that. But me and my cousin, we were living high on the hog, but we were living 20 miles outside of the San Fernando Valley in Moore Park, California, because that's where he lived. And we had a condo. He just went through a big breakup, and we were going to town. We were buying, you know, $1,000 duvets, you know, down comforters and halogen lighting. And we were living it up on stolen credit cards. And when I ran into Everlast and he was going through that, I said, come out, move with, you can live in with us. We got a room for you. We'll take care of you. And when he came, he stayed for about a month or two before he ended up moving with his girlfriend. And we just started to talk. And I told you, I was at a record store, at a chain record store called The Warehouse. It was a popular, you know, record chain. It was a, you know, massive record chain in California. I don't know if it was, I think it was nationwide. And I liberated a lot of their CDs back in the day. They were like gold. And I was able to amass a pretty fucking incredible collection of music. And I may be a little OCD in some areas. So if I had a cassette tape, and it didn't have the J card, which is the artwork, I would create new artwork by going to Kinko's and drawing up. And I had this little tape called House of Pain because I had dabbled in making like a four track with a couple other dudes. And when Everlast moved in, he was tripping out on my music because being at a record store, you'll get bored quickly with the whatever is on the shelves. I don't care what genre you're in. And hip hop was a very small amount of like records at the time. Mm-hmm. Still single driven. There was maybe 10 hip hop records that were actually on our shelves and everything else was other music. So being at the record store for 2 years, you just start to listen to everything. I was taking anything I wanted off the shelves, taking it in the back. If I liked it, it's mine. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I would take it home with me and never bring it back. And so I had my room looked like a record store. I had a punk rock section, an R&B section, a reggae section, a hip hop section, and then a rando section. And Everlast saw the House of Pain name and he goes, oh, I love this. What is it? And I said, yo, it's like, you know, a concept. I wanted to do this thing. And it's, you know, it's Irish style hip hop. And he was like, well, I'm part Irish. My, you know, I think his grandmother, Rita Rose Mulligan. I'll always remember it. I believe that's her name. If I fucked it up, I apologize. But he was, and at the time, you got to imagine what Suicidal Tendencies did for their, you know, there was a band and then they had a gang with it. TSOL yeah. had a gang with their band that would follow. Well, House of Pain became like the defunct, like the band for Mickey Mouse Club. So I still had a bunch of dudes that I was like still running with. Everlast had never really had that kind of situation where he had five or six dudes now with us at all times that were like big and up. You know what we were doing. We both end up moving to Hollywood, and Eric goes off, and we start to build this thing, and we run into Muggs from Cypress Hill, who he had known from the Rhyme Syndicate era, and the rest is history. And so, and there's a lot of millions of things that happen in between, but you get he came back with the demo of Jump Around. I played it in my living room. We all went bonkers, and at that moment, we knew shit was going to change.
That's so, what I wanted to get to. So when that song changed. Blows up, like what happens, man? Like what does that feel like for you?
I start having panic attacks because my whole life, people, my mother included, I mean, I think it starts with her. I don't think people, but you're going to be just like your father, dead or in prison by the time you're 21. And now everybody's telling me,
yeah,
you're going to be fucking famous. This thing is going to blow, kid. This fucking is, yo, you guys are going to. And it was so foreign to me because I kept, you know, and listen, to my mother's words, I was living up to that shit. I was like, oh, I'll show you, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, I was, you know, the files exist for all the shit that I was into. So it's like, it's not like it's a fairy tale story. I was doing everything I needed to do to find myself in prison by 21. Oh, to that story, when I got arrested that time for during the curfew,
yeah.
The lady says, oh, happy birthday, honey. You 21. I said, uh-uh. I said, my birthday is tomorrow, ma'am. She said, "Ah, oh, it's midnight." I was like, "Oh shit!" And then I heard my mother say, "You're going to be just like your father, dead or in prison by the time you're 21."
Man,
and sure as shit, I wasn't. I didn't go to prison, but I was getting booked into the West Valley. I was like, "Shit, she got me." So it was like that. That song, when you play it in your living room for your friends, if your friends are anything like my friends, we're dicks. We're going to tell you this thing sucks, or get off your own dick. It ain't all that. When we played this thing, strangers were walking by. I go, "What the fuck is that? Where do I get that?" I'd play it on auto repeat. We were jumping in my living room, breaking my own shit because the impact of that was immediately felt. Then we tested it. We had it on our manager at the time. She had a nightclub, and we got them to play it, and the club went nuts. And every time they played it, it just kept getting worse. I mean, it was a phenomenon, bro. And it's still, as we speak.
There's not a kid our age that didn't want to have a Celtics jersey and a black hoodie. And just, right?
Or a mailman hat, too, or right?
That's all I was going to say, man. Mailman hat.
Exactly.
I still got it. I still got it over there. And I got my UPS one, too, from Who's the Man. I found it in a box of shit. Let me tell you this. At 54 years old, when I tell people now, they're like, "What do you do? Who do you? You were in some band?" And I was like, "Yeah, House of Pain." And they're like, "No idea." They're like, "Have you ever been to a sporting event?" They're like, "Of course." I'm like, "You ever heard of Jump Around?" They're like, "Oh shit, yo!" So the song is still, the reason why people know. We made 3 good records. The first will always be my favorite because it was organic. It was in the moment. It was like 30 days later we had the first album. My hat's always off to Everlast. He's an incredible musician. As we grew in different directions. We didn't always see eye to eye. We're politically different. We're just different people, man. And this is I don't fault him or myself for growing apart. You got to be true to yourself and what you need to do. There was a lot of disappointment. I felt abandoned when he left the group. He had his reasons, And I felt like, fuck, I didn't have a B plan. I was all in on House of Pain. And so when he pulled off and then rode off into the sunset, and Lethal rode off into the sunset with, Limp Bizkit, I was devastated by all that. But after, years of looking back and whatever, listen, I'm responsible for my own destiny and my own life. I had to go find it. I was unwilling because if you know any alcoholic addict, you'll find the common thread is there's a lot of egomanias acts with low self-esteem, and I qualified for that. I was like, I can't go get a real job. I'm Danny Boy from House of Pain. How can I go work at Starbucks? And then the fear of I'm not even smart enough to work at Starbucks. It's got a fucking cash register. I don't know how to use that, I wasn't. Yeah. So I started to do drugs and just hopefully it would all go away. I hope the cloud would just pass and then magically my life would get better. And that did not happen for me. I really had to just get willing to build a new life.
What was your breaking point, man? What made you get sober?
It wasn't. I mean, listen, I had a million different things that was good, great reasons to get sober. I just got like a most garden variety addict alcoholics. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Mm. I got sober originally in year 2000, and I had 3.5 years, or close to 3.5 years, when I decided, oh, meth was my problem, but I should be able to drink. I've been a good boy for three and change. I went out and tried it. When you're in a 12-step program, that literature says, if you don't think you're a real alcoholic, go try some controlled drinking. So I took that. I said, I'm going to go try it. And I did it successfully for like 72 hours. It was great. I was fucking in the fetal position in no time. And then I called the drug dealer, and they're like, really? They're like, you? I'm like, yeah. I said, it's not for me. They're like, oh, sure it isn't. I'll be right over it. And I was right back on methamphetamines. And I thought, well, if this goes Spanish on me, I can always go back to the 12-step program. And it went bad quick. And I go back. I couldn't hear the message anymore. I was unwilling to. Something had changed. The first time was a gift. And it took about three years of a downward spiral to finally get a window of opportunity. And in that window of opportunity, I had the realization that if I wasn't probably going to be one of the lucky ones that would die out there, I was going to live a really fucking bad life on my knees for a long time if something didn't change. And that if all I got out of sobriety this time was sobriety, it had to be enough, because I got sober. I got a side deal. I made $500,000 on a record that never came out. And when that record didn't come out, I started like, boo hoo. Like, I didn't get sober to be, have this happen. I put conditions on my sobriety, and the conditions were that I was going to be restored to House of Pain glory, or
or music greatness, and that if I didn't make $1 million and have a luxury automobile, that why would I stay sober? So I made that mistake. I sold myself something that wasn't guaranteed. That, you know, the 12 steps promise you, if you do them, that you will have a psychic and a spiritual experience strong enough to keep you from that. And that you, the promises are happy, joyous, and free. And I am happy, I am joyous, and I am definitely free. And drug addiction and alcoholism is truly a sentence that, like I said, it's so much easier for me to just to it's a way better life than I could ever imagine. And that's from a guy who made a living off of being drunk and being Irish. If I can do it, anybody has a shot at doing it. You can't be too dumb for this thing. You can only be too smart. I've watched way smarter dudes than me psychoanalyze and decide that they need to go out and try this experiment, and they haven't made it back. I watched a lot of people try what I tried. I don't know. I made it back by the skin of my teeth, and which I had very little when I got in. Like, you know, I put $70,000 into this set of teeth because of the amount of damage that I did, and I was semi homeless, very few teeth in my mouth. Warrant for my arrest, suspended driver's license. I mean, talk about, you know, I was at rock bottom, and I was down there for a while before that window of opportunity. And it was really just somebody reaching out saying, I'm in Hollywood. If you ever think about coming back to meetings. And this time I was just like, I have nothing to lose. I have to do this. Cause at that moment I was suicidal and homicidal, and I won't get into why, but because it just take another hour to, but you know, I can go from chilling to killing real quick. And when you're in that depth of that, I wanted to kill myself, but I also wanted to kill somebody else. Cause I was just like, this is the reason why. And I found that window of opportunity. And this time I didn't want my old life back in sobriety. I wanted a new life. And that's exactly what I got. And it took a while, man. I mean, at 10 years, I got my chip and I was like, fuck, this is so crazy. How did I get 10 years? And the next thought was, where's my shit? Like, where's my white picket fence and my career? My buddy said, don't leave before the miracle. And a couple of years later, here I was in Tulsa with this house. And the miracle took longer than I thought. In my, you know, the things that I wanted. But you know what? God, found something that I could do for the rest of my life and not get bored, because there's so much to chew on with the outsiders, between the author, S.E. Hinton and her work, Francis Ford Coppola and his hand in this, and Rumblefish, which is another one of her book, the city I love, the aesthetics I love. I'm an all-American kind of, I love, you know, old cars and denim jackets and switchblades and all of the cool 50s shit that's in there, you know, 50s and 60s Americana. There's just nothing I don't love about it. And then at the end of the day, I'm able to be of service, because this museum's open only 3 days a week to the public, but we're open for school tours and private tours Monday through Thursday. And we have school tour after school tour. Sometimes today we had three different tours at three different schools and the Rotary Club come visit. And these kids are reading it. It's the most read seventh grade book for seventh graders in the U.S. and now worldwide. Librarians and English teachers love teaching this book. So the kids here, they come from all over. They come from even other states. They read the book. They see the movie, and then they come to the museum and they have a Willy Wonka experience at the Chocolate Factory for its greaser stuff. They come all dressed up. I don't care if they're rich kids. They come dressed up as greasers. Everybody wants to be a greaser when they have a choice to dress some type of way. And I can only put myself in, I wish in seventh grade I would have read the book and got a tour to the it would have been life-changing. So by default, it's not what I set out to do. I set out to make a middle-aged greaser museum for us to look at the knives and the jackets. But what I did on accident was make a museum that has an educational component to it. And these kids realized that this girl who wrote the book was kind of just like them. She failed English and got a D+ in Korea. If for the ones who are not doing good, for the Mensa students and the straight A students, they're not worried about it. They're into all of the other stuff. But there are kids that go like, oh, why, you know, how could I do that? Same way she did. Keep showing up, keep writing your story. There's no, you know, you may not test well in the school system, but you may test well. He can't test for me for hip hop either.
Right.
They couldn't test me for creative direction. They can't. So that's those are things that you just, so we try to foster the attitude there with the kids that, listen, this too could be your story, or you might just have a good day off from school. Either one. Write your story, or do you want to be in acting or set design or wardrobe or just photography, or here's somebody who persisted in the Midwest as a female in the 60s, in her teens, who wrote an American classic, was turned into a movie by Francis Ford Coppola, starred some of the greatest 80s actors, the Brat Pack. Mm-hmm. It's a remarkable story, and it gives these kids hope, because it doesn't hit the same when it's a New Yorker or an LA guy, because they're like, well, we're not in LA. This is not, you know, possible for us.
Yeah.
This is their story. And this is something that I try to tell kids, man. Now more than ever, you have a real opportunity to, because you have an authentic voice, which is not being heard in LA or New York, because it's a Tulsa voice. It's an Oklahoma voice. It's a Midwest voice. Use it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so,
well, that's what I was going to say, that the secret recipe kind of being in a smaller city. I mean, Tulsa's still a pretty big city. I mean, according to not to LA or New York, Chicago. But
no, of course, it's got a million people, and that's not even a million proper. So it's small, but yes, it's not it's not like a two horse town either.
Right. So then the whole idea of everybody coming together, contributing to the museum, and you kind of not. I mean, mm-hmm. you knew you had your vision, and that's what I was going to say too. Is the whole background where you have marketing, you've created things for House of Pain, the outsiders, mm-hmm. the merchandise, I've got a coffee mug sitting right here that's stamped Stay Gold. Awesome. That I ordered from there. That shirt, I think Fantastic. You're wearing, the gray one, is like one of my favorite shirts, like perfectly cut. Yeah, that's it. Yes.
I appreciate it.
But that whole idea is, while music is amazing, very few people ever get to make music and make money off of it, and make songs or a record or multiple records that people still listen to, and then transition into another life where you've created something that I would have loved to have gone to as a kid. When I saw The Outsiders first, I didn't read the book until I was an adult. I didn't read a lot of books.
Same. Why would I read it? Like, there's a perfectly good movie out there.
Yeah, and that movie came out, and my mom and dad had split when I was a kid. And that was my dad's thing. Like, on the weekends, we'd go see him. He worked in the beer business and did beer route. So we'd ride with him on the beer route and then go watch a movie. So it was like Porky's, Officer and a Gentleman.
Oh, wow.
And, he didn't care, dude. I mean, we were little kids.
Porky's was great. Yeah, me and my mother didn't either.
Yeah,
they tried to shame her for taking us to Saturday Night Fever because she's a disco and loved dancing. We were like, fuck those motherfuckers. We were New Yorkers. We didn't care what they thought of us in L.A.
Yeah, so when we saw The Outsiders, I was – blown away, man. And that opened up the whole door for him to tell me what life was like when he lived in San Diego in the 60s. And even then they had greasers and socias and jocks and everybody was fighting it out. But no, it's incredible. And eventually I want to be able to get out there and take a look at it.
Yeah. It would be fantastic. Listen, this is why it resonates, and it will always be, it's a story as old as time. There's always the haves and the have nots, the working class, the rich. But our job as humans is to find, and it's similar to sobriety, man. And you know, I don't know if he knows this, and I only tell you because, you know, somebody told me, I'll just keep it anonymous, but somebody, a famous musician, when I first came into sobriety, I came in with the Ferrari and leather pants and all that stuff. And then I heard people sharing about shooting up out of the gutters in Hollywood. And I was like, okay, this ain't for me. And then about a year later, I came in on wounded knee. And my buddy said, and I told him that he's like, and this guy's a famous, famous musician. And he said, mate, you need to start looking for the similarities and not the differences. And that's, you hear that a lot in the 12-step program. When you shift your perspective, when I do this and with people, I feel like this is for everybody. When I look for the differences, they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. I can find a reason to separate from, but when I look at the similarities, I start to find a common thread. And I think for me, what I got out of The Outsiders as a story was these guys were looking just for, to be accepted, to look out for each other's interests, and then to be understanding of everything else. And these kids now, they have a better grasp of like, hey man, it's okay to express your feelings. When I was growing up, you kept all that to yourself. Yeah. You were weak if you said you felt some type of way, or you hurting inside, or your mom doesn't love you, or your dad is dead, or you couldn't even, people they would bag on you. I go, you know, and I guess what I'm trying to say, because my mind gets all over the place with this, is that our true nature, before we get all the other shit that goes in there, is to try to find the common ground, to try to build. We're nomadic, but we're also tribal, and to build a village. And really, that's like a in my mind, that's what the outsiders was trying to do. They were trying to take the broken pieces and build something good out of it. And I try mm-hmm. to do that wherever I go. And that was the appeal to it for me. It was just try to, like, you know, find the similarities, man. And it's almost like I feel like somebody wrote this book about, like, they took the Big Lebowski and they took, like, dude-isms. Like, yeah. You could do greaserisms and find, or like to dissect the outsiders and find a lot of good, like, philosophical, like, you know, things in there that would get you through life. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
I love what I do, man. It all starts with gratitude. I'm so grateful that I get to do this. I don't have mm-hmm. to do a damn thing. I get to do it. And that includes yeah. laundry or, you know, walking the dog, or I get to do all these things, man. If the second I forget that, the second all of this shit changes. And so,
yeah, if I could back up, man, you kind of, and you don't have to speak about it. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It's something I didn't know about you. You mentioned something about being in a motorcycle club.
Oh yeah. During House of Pain. Okay. And this is where during House of Pain, I was always fascinated with the Hell's Angels. I'm sure everybody, you know, as a kid at some point, as Americans, I mean, the rebel has always been something to us, whether it's yeah. Marlon Brando and the Wild One or the Hell's Angels, or even the Mafia thing when I was a kid was like, you know, we were so intrigued by it. And during the House of Pain era, I met Chuck Zito through a mutual friend who just was here actually last week with me from Brooklyn, whose dad knew Chuck. And Chuck was working on the on a Schwarzenegger movie. Who Chuck, if you don't know, is a pretty notable Hell's Angel. I think he's since put the patch down, but he's a New York Hell's Angel, very notable dude, and has a lot of Hollywood contacts. So he met us on 42nd Street during the filming of The Last Commando, or one of these Schwarzenegger movies where they paid like $4 million to redo the 42nd Street, which was full of like porn joints and kung fu shops back then.
Yeah.
And I met him, and, you know, I don't want to say we hit it off, but he was super cool and super, you know, like, nice to meet you. And there was no cell phones back then. We weren't doing selfies. And then he said, hey, I got a friend in Oakland who's an Irish guy who really loves your band, man, and I want to put you in contact. And I started to, you know, I met that gentleman, and we hit it off. His name is Mark Perry. He's no longer with us. But he would come down from Oakland with a few Hell's Angels, come into Hollywood. I'd bring out the bike that I had. Mickey Rourke lent me his I was, you know, friends with Mickey. Mickey lent me the Harley Davidson Marble Man bike, which had a starter problem. It had a Bendix gear. I don't even know what the Bendix gear is. We'd had a bump start that fucking thing. And I'd get so high and drunk, I'd leave it out on the strip, and nobody would even steal it because they thought it was a replica. Don't tell Mickey that. Well, he'll know now. But I don't give a fuck. I mean, I got it impounded. I had to have another guy get it out because I didn't even have a motorcycle license. So that bike was an impound. People thought it was like a stunt double, or it wasn't the real thing, but it was the real thing. Anyway, I was fascinated with that. I may have had delusions that I was someday going to be an angel, but that was never going to happen. And I was never, you know, and then another club came to town and it was a green one. And they were recruiting heavily at that time, and being 6'6" and alpha male and just starting to dabble in methamphetamines. A lot of people who were like, hey, brother, you should come ride with us. And at the time, it was what I needed because I knew House of Pain. The writing was on the wall. We were at our third album at that point. We weren't getting along internally. The money was starting to dry up. And, you know, again, in a panic mode, I was like, this is the brotherhood I need. You know, I need like brothers with my, trying to replicate something, a system that would look out for me in my time of need. And then I could also provide some, you know, benefit to them. I was visible. I was, you know, in their eyes, I was still rich, you know? And so it was cool for a while. It turned out to not be so cool. I left after like a year and change, maybe 2 years into that thing. My experiences was like being a bike club is like being in a pyramid scheme, man. I mean, you kick up all the way to the top of that pyramid. There was a fine for everything. It was there was a mandatory this, mandatory that. I'm not built for mandatory. Like, just don't like being told I'm mandatory. I have to call every Wednesday and leave a message. I randomly have to, you know, it was a lot of stuff that you don't see. Mm-hmm. And I get it. As I got older, I understood that that's the dedication that they need from you to be in that. I'm not knocking that. And I'm not, listen, it was something I was like, even for me, I was like, fuck, that was a crazy time. But I just was not in a, I had no discipline back then. I was new to drugs. So I was starting to go in all different directions and I couldn't show up for myself. There was no way I was going to show up for the club in the way that they needed me to show up long term. Mm-hmm. So it was a bad fit for both of us, I'm sure. But yeah. I ended up walking away. And ironically, I'm friends online with the guy. I don't think he's still in the club neither. He's a, he threatened me on the way out. And I remember I had, you know, I brought my 45 with me and I was like, and he wasn't from our chapter, but they sent him just to like, to, and he, I remember him saying something about knocking some teeth or something. And nobody talked to me like that back in those days or any, they weren't talking to me this way today. Yeah. And I remember thinking, just eat it, Danny, because this ain't going to go good if you don't. And it wasn't physically threatened. Mm-hmm. But I would, I remember feeling like if he tries, because he was a kickboxer at the time, and I'm nice with mines too, but he was, and I was like, this is going to end up bad. And then he just got out of my way and I walked out the door. Now, I believe that there's a guy on the internet and he seems like a great fucking dude. I did some interview where somebody in the biker world, I think it was George Christie and me, the former Hells Angel, were talking because I knew him also. He popped up and said, "Hey man, this is so-and-so." And I think that's the fucking dude that threatened me on the way out. But it was protocol to do that, man. You know, you're not going to just, just hand in your cut and be like, "Oh, love you, brother. See you later." Yeah. My crew couldn't do it. So they had another dude that was like, "Hey brother, that's fucking some punk shit to just quit up on the club. I should knock your fucking teeth down your throat." And I'm like, "They can try it, motherfucker." But I was shaking because I was up for 3 days. It was super hard for me to give my cut back because I was just, I felt embarrassed to do so. I mean, they, you know, I also understand how that world works. And I, there was the last thing in my mind when I joined was that I was going to be quitting out on it. And there I was quitting out on it. And it was for the better. Looking back, it was best for both of us. They did, you know what I mean? And I'm sure, you know, nobody missed me, but I was just, I couldn't get my own shit together. So showing up for a club. So again, is it advisable? No. Do I still romance it when I see, you know, all of these old photos of all these clubs? There's part of me that will always like that group mentality. And you probably find the same thing if you work it, if you're a military or law enforcement or any other, there's a family bond, man. And we love that as humans. We love to have a tribe or a fucking somebody who's got your best interest that's doing what you do, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. You know, and so I was looking for that. I was just on the other side of shit. I always tell my friend, we have a mutual friend who works LAPD, is a detective. And I was always like, fuck, I wish I would have met you back in the days. I would have loved to. You think motherfuckers get pensions and get, you know. I'm like, but then I was like, dude, you are never showing up on Thanksgiving, holidays. Yeah. He's like, dude, you know how many times I had to work on all of that for 20 years?
Yeah.
You just don't have, you know, until he got some seniority. Now, you know, he does his thing. But
yeah,
it's a fantasy for me. But this is why when I really know what goes into anything, listen, you have to find what you're passionate about and do it. And I've been lucky twice in my life. Originally it was hip hop. I was passionate enough about it and it worked because of a lot of other, you know, great creative talents. But this one, it was somebody else's project or movie and book. I was a fan, but it was kind of out there in the abyss. You know, people kind of forgot about it. And I took what I learned and developed during my career as a hip hop guy with the branding and the promoting. And, you know, I got to speak next week to a school about just this, about marketing. And there's just like anything else, like no answer is an answer. You know, if somebody doesn't return a call, that's an answer.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Over marketing or under marketing. Also, you have to know there's balances and parameters. So you said you like the shirt I wear. It's very indicative of most of the designs that I do, which are very stoic, classic, not too overbearing. With the Outsiders, I knew my parameters. I knew that this was a classic American literature piece that was turned into a movie. I don't want to do stuff that looks wild. I don't want to do very big colory, you know, out of the wrong context and era. And you really have to know at that point your shit, because you could also muddy up or mucky up something that is in good standing. You don't want to then put it like and bastardize it, oversell it, over milk it. And so I'm very, very cautious and intentional when I design or hire other people to you know, make designs for us. than it is up to par, but I do it well. And for me, that's my bread and butter. The museum does good, but the merch does better. And it's because people feel that it's part and parcel. It goes together very well with you know.
Yeah, it's on message. It feels authentic, like you said. It captures that same aesthetic of the 1560s. But also the cut of that shirt, that gray shirt. I don't know what the
you like that bullshit. It's like Bell and Canvas, I believe.
Yeah,
that's the blank we're using. On those. That one, you can get them on.
I've got the black and white one too. It's like the Ringer shirt, you know, the sleeves, yeah. Ringer neck. But where you said you were, I cut you off, man. You were saying you can get them on the website.
Get them on the website. Yeah. Although, theoutsidershouse.com or just go on Facebook, you'll find us. For me, I couldn't imagine. I don't know how, you know, I got to speak next week at a high school about marketing. And then there's part of me who feels, I told the kid too, originally I told him, he's my lawyer's son's, and who wants me to come speak. And I originally turned him down, which I felt bad. And then his father said, hey man, his heart's broken. He thought you were going to come speak. So then this happened just actually today. So I recalled him and said, listen, I just don't want to come down there and be inauthentic. I'm not a marketing expert. I said, I'm an expert in marketing when it comes to the stuff that I'm doing, but that doesn't mean it's applicable to anything. I said, I have a very unique situation where I was a former, you know, dare I say, you know, famous rapper who then came to a town to celebrate the under-celebrated legacy of S.C. Hinton and the Outsiders, which was kind of been forgotten for, you know, not forgotten, but, you know, it was just kind of on the back burner and put it back on the front burner. So there's a lot of leverage to that when you got like Matt Dillon and Rob Lowe and Tom Cruise and Coppola and S.C. Hinton and all of that.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot easier than starting from scratch in your basement on a product. Okay. And yes, The Outsiders it was already popping in the world of like pop culture, and House of Pain was started from scratch, but it's a lot easier to parlay into that. And that's exactly what I'm gonna tell these kids. But I also had to tell him, listen, there's fear. I didn't want to come in there and tell you guys, I don't blow smoke. I didn't want to give you bad advice. He goes, no, the guy just, similar to what we're doing now. He said, my teacher's a fan of not only The Outsiders, but of House of Pain and your whole story and how this came about. And really that's what he wants to talk to you to talk to us about, is how this comes about and you know, that kind of stuff. And that makes a lot more sense. And so that's the purpose, really, is just to be, the more I tell my story, the more I hope people realize that, man, I got a ninth grade education. I had no real money to do what I'm doing. I was humble enough, and I say humble enough because my ego always gets in the way, and for a long time it's prevented me from saying I need help, you know, and I asked for that help, and miraculous things happen. And then again, for me, it was sobriety was another key, and the gratitude in all of it, to just be like, and a lot of times, I mean, I don't hear that in stories. I hear all these phenomenal stories, and that's why I was a little salty at 10 years when I get my 10-year sobriety chip. Because I'd hear people come in, they were like, yeah, I was blowing hobos on Santa Monica Boulevard 2 weeks ago. Then I got sober. And a year later, after being a messenger on Warner Brothers lot, they promoted me to head of films. And now I make $20 million a year. I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, where's my, you know, my head was like, what? I'm still out here trying to make, you know. And so I had to realize that, you know, for me, the universe, God, whatever what you like. For me, it's God had a plan for me. It just took a lot longer than I liked it to take. And once I found what my true purpose was to be the custodian of this legacy, I do it with all my heart and I do it with all intent. Man, I'm very conscientious of not to step on her toes, being the author or the stars, to put them in a bad light or to do anything, you know. And that comes down to also how I behave outside when I'm out there, just with, you know. I can't, if you cut me off in traffic, I don't have, I can't react like I used to react,
because it's
a bad look. And so everything changes. And so I'm so happy to be on this side of things, man, and talking to you guys and about how I ended up over here. But I feel that everybody has a fighting chance at their purpose and their success story. It probably won't look anything like this, but, you know, completely better or different in many ways. So.
Yeah,
and that's amazing. You can't ever stop telling your story. I mean, you were put here to tell your story.
Imagine you on coke, you wouldn't get a word in edgewise if I was on
Hey, look, we always start like talking towards the end. We always talk about music, and the best part about it is you've got a wide spectrum of music. So usually we talk about like music, a band, a song, an artist, something that you would recommend to someone listening. You know what I mean? Like people are listening to the show right now. Put them on something that's either new
It's what we started with. It's it's a band called Wire.
Okay.
And the album is called Pink Flag. Mm-hmm. And when you hear it, which is also crazy because when I heard like, I think it's like song 3 or 4, I go, holy shit, this is the riff that they stole for. And I couldn't remember the song. And then I got it. It's Elastica. Yeah. Dun, dun, dun.
Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Dun, dun. It's a rip from that band. And then once I could put the two together, I Googled it. And then all the, you know, people have already sussed it out. And then the two times you or, you know, the my favorite Minor Threat song is a cover from Wire, Pink Flag. So it's Wire, Pink Flag. I believe it's 78 or 79 that the record came out. And to me, I don't know much more than that, but it feels like a record that everybody who makes records probably devoured this record and then stole a piece and then repitched it as our new sound. Because when you listen to it, man, I was just blown away because I had seen the shirts before, or Pink Flag. I thought it was like a bullshit little band that was trying to copy Black Flag and go, we're Pink Flag, we're White Flag, because there's a White Flag too.
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
I thought it was just some like local bullshit. Mm-hmm. Come to find out, it's not. It's from the 70s. It's I think it's credited as being the first post-punk album, and it's genius, man. So that would be – I can't think of anything that would top that at this moment.
I'm pretty sure there's another white rapper from the 90s that stole a pretty popular riff and made a lot of money.
There's a handful, brother. You're talking about. I mean, that's the name of the game back then, right?
Yeah. I'm pretty certain.
Ski, what are you going with, man?
Oh, you're gonna love this one, man. It's a band that BC and I just saw not too long ago. But I'm gonna go with the band and a very specific song, and you're gonna understand the reason. Let's just go with Helmet, Just Another Victim.
There you go.
Boom.
I just seen Paige. He played my buddy's place, the Venue Shrine. What a great guy, the singer and writer.
Yeah. I just stepped all over you.
So crunchy. No, you're good, brother. Listen, they were so, I mean, that they play as well as that album was so perfect. That just that crunchy. Mm-hmm. I love that band. Yeah.
Yeah, Ski just stole mine, man. It's funny. We don't talk about too? Yeah, because the reason I say that is the Judgment Night soundtrack. I still to this day play that song, that whole soundtrack from the movie Judgment Night. You know what I'm saying? And so a lot of people will ask me about music back then, and I don't want to get into it now, but I often talk about like the hijacking of hip hop, where people basically took it in such a negative route and people weren't getting paid and just it got so negative. But I talk about how on that Judgment Night soundtrack, all these bands that were just in their perfect vibe making songs together. And it's still like incredible. Put on Onyx and Biohazard, put on Ice-T and Slayer,
The great thing about that record, it was Ricky Rackman's sister, Karen Rackman, who was doing music supervision. I don't know if you know Ricky Rackman from the Headbangers Ball.
Yeah.
He had the Cat House, which was like the famous rock club in Hollywood. His sister did the music supervision for that. And I think Everlast, because he was in that movie, he had a hand in telling them, hey, I want to do a song, but I don't want to sample an old record. He didn't want to do Run DMC Aerosmith, where there was already a hit that Aerosmith had, and then them rhyme over it, even though that was brilliant in its time. Yeah. This was like, you know, 93, and we were past that. And he was like, I want to actually work with the band and create new stuff. So Just Another Victim was the title track on that thing. And that was the first one. And then they were like, okay, let's follow suit. Let's put Slayer with Ice-T, or I don't remember the collabos, but it was Cypress Hill and Onyx and Biohazard and Ice-T,
Mudhoney.
All of those things. And
Mudhoney
was on there. Yeah. So it was what I think why it stands out so much is because it was two people authentically creating new stuff And that was really the changing of the old guard. I mean, it happened with the Aerosmith Run DMC. It was both bands who were like, listen, this shit is okay to do both. Because I was trying to say earlier, and I forgot, you know, if you come out of the country club at 2 a.m, because that's when LA shuts down, and you come out of the Sherman Square roller rink, you were two different scenes. And those scenes would clash. You couldn't be a rocker, and then those dudes were talking shit, you know. We call those dudes hashers. They're calling you the F word, which is not, you know.
Yeah,
they're calling you fag and this and that, and you're just going at it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, Lollapalooza kind of hit. Well, the Run DMC thing with Aerosmith kind of was like a good indication that people could like both things. And then when Lollapalooza hit, man, it was like, whoa! Like here's Perry Farrell with Ice-T and Living Colour, mm-hmm. Doozy and the Banshees, and the world was starting to go, okay, we don't have to just be rock dudes, or we don't have to just be like, hip hop can still have, like, there was a crossover that was authentic. Where it's like, dude, yeah, who didn't like Susie and the Banshees and like Metallica? And I didn't love the hard rock stuff growing up. I really didn't. Mm-hmm. It was just too status quo, and the dudes that were into it were just dick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like new wave and then hip hop and punk rock. But as I got older, I was like, dude, how can I deny the Metallica song? When I saw that video, it was the first video that Metallica ever did. I worked at the record store. We sold it on VHS tape. Rockers came from all over to buy it. So I put it on in the back, and when I'm hearing like, and he's like, darkness is visiting me. All that I see. I'm like, these rhyming really over that. I'm like, oh my God, I think I like Metallica. I was like a coming out party. I was like, holy shit. My hair grew an inch just by admitting that I liked Metallica for the first time. Yeah. And it wasn't soon after that, like, the world kind of just goes, dude, it's okay. You can like a little bit. You can like Madonna and still like Metallica. Like, well, there's not a, you know, who cares? Like, we're all.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, that's why that soundtrack was so cool, because by the time that was put together, all of these bands had that same synergy. It was like the same energy was like that 90s angst, whether it was coming from hip-hop or alternative or rock or whatever. It was still like, and it captured it.
Yeah, it was cool at that time, too, because you could move in and out of music like that. And a lot of the guys I grew up with, we all listened to Public Enemy. And we were like, Public Enemy sounded like the same message a lot of punk and hardcore bands have, but they're doing 100%. It with hip-hop. But it's like,
100%.
It's like reading, you know, philosophy or studying sociology with Chuck D.
No, so then you, incredible.
You end up having all these bands merging on that soundtrack. And I've seen the movie like maybe once, but the soundtrack, we couldn't get enough of it. Like I said, I still played about once a month.
You're 100% right. Even the punk dudes that were like apprehensive did not like hip-hop. Mm-hmm. As soon as they started to like the ice started to break and there was like okay, it's cool. They went straight for NWA, Public Enemy, Too Short, like all of the like real egregious, heavy, like they weren't looking out for like, you know, MC Hammer, or not to throw him under the bus or any of that shit, but they weren't looking for like radio pop shit. They wanted the most nastiest, blackest, like, you know, militant shit that they could find. And it's the same angst. It's the same aggression. Yeah. I always tell people at 54, I missed punk, the true like 77 to whatever of like British punk. I was too young, man. I still wasn't. That was still like scary music to me. By the time I discovered in the form of skate punk, Suicidal Tendencies, it was the stories that he was telling. I seen your mommy and your mommy's dad. I was like, damn, that's creepy, but it's kind of cool. All I wanted was a Pepsi, you know? I get it. Cause I lived that real time, man. And it's great that people don't have those hangups anymore. Now, the bad part of that is I see kids in the, you know, with their moms at like 2 years old with a faux hawk and a Ramones shirt. And I'm like, you knocked that off. I'll say this. I'm sorry to cut you off. I've met a lot of latent punks, and I lived in a neighborhood with a kid, Bob Raft, and his older brother got stabbed at a gig, unfortunately. And it made a lot of news back. I think it was Minor Threat too. And they were punk, man. And they put up with a lot of shit, man. People would spit at this dude at school and call him, this, that, and the third. And he paid a real heavy price for that. And God bless him, because that was the badge of honor that you wore when you did that. And so it kind of, it's nobody's fault. It's not a, it's not, it's just, it's an observation from a guy who grew up in an era where you wear a shirt like that, you could get stomped out at the mall just because these dudes are all wearing Dio and Aussie shirts and they're not trying to see some dude with spikes wearing an exploited shirt. That's just easy target. Yeah, and it works the other way too. If those dudes were in masks, they'd beat up these dudes, you know?
Yeah. It's, and I try not
different to, world.
Yeah. I try not to be that like guard, you know, old guard or whatever. So I try to introduce as much of that music to younger people as I possibly can. And then I'm always thankful that some of the young people that really, really appreciate it, like, and that they're not going through the same things that we went through. Cause I did, I used to get chased, getting fights. You're swinging your skateboards at like dudes with mullets and stuff. And
that's it.
But I don't want it to be that way. No, yeah. I want everybody to
know. I get it. And again, I just, there's part of me that's still like when I see it with, when you know, the kids got the shirts that they're in the mall, I'm like,
that might be a little bit of like the hijacking and punk. Like I said, the hijacking and hip hop.
Hey, I'm going to tell you what, you know, we talk about marketing and all that stuff. Being a B-boy, being in a hip-hop at that era in a suburban, basically a middle-class to upper-middle-class neighborhood where I grew up, it was not easy to find Puma suede Clydes. It was not easy to find Cazelle sunglasses or glasses or Kangols. We had to go on missions for this shit. You couldn't just go on eBay or Instagram or whatever and find this stuff at the and have it delivered. So it was part of the hunter-gatherer in me. And I know punk was like that as well. If you wanted anything, you had to go on a mission and find other dudes that were willing to risk it to go on those missions, to go to the swap meet in South Central Los Angeles and buy those kind of sneakers, buy those kind of hats. But, and in doing so, it was your, this is why I was so like enamored by it, because we earned that shit. It was not just something.
Yeah.
And I, in the same way, you know, we had to pay a price for it. I know it's a completely different experience for these younger kids because they don't know what it's like to, it's almost like, I wish they could understand as well that, yeah, man, you had to fight for it back in the days and it made it that much more sacred to you. Now, again, we can all, and I'm guilty of it too. Anything new comes up, I Google it, I see it, I order it, it's in my door in 3 days. No problem. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, look,
I got a question real quick because it's right on topic with this. When are Danny Boy's Top of the Morning to You toothpicks going to be back in stock? Because I need one of those.
I know you need those. I'll reorder just for you, man. I'll put those out for those that don't know. We made some custom switchblades and they did well, man. I can't keep them in it, but I also try not to OD on them and make too many so that they're, but you're absolutely, right. I need to make a new batch. I make them in small batches. I got a guy in Florida who makes them for me custom. It's like
they're pretty, though.
No money in his pocket. Put a little thing. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And I'll make another dozen, put them out there and give you a heads up, man.
That's
do
awesome.
Do it. Well, we appreciate you coming on, man. We could talk all day. And if you're cool with it, we'd love to bring you back on. We'll pick some other topics, man. At some point, man.
Yeah. Well, you know what I'd like to do with next time you guys got to come out to Tulsa. We'll do it live from the Outsider's house.
And you're done.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Cool
done.
That's so cool. Hey, man, I just want to say I appreciate how humble you are, and I appreciate you telling your story, man. And you don't give yourself enough credit, man. And just keep telling your story and keep inspiring.
We appreciate you coming on, buddy. Disruptors.
All right, guys. Appreciate
Disruptors
it. Hey, stay gold.
Yes, sir.
Nice.